All right, good evening, everyone. So tonight I'd like to explore this topic of contact for one more night, particularly in how there's this release into stillness, which is available with that exploration of contact. We gave a hint of that in the meditation, this guided meditation. And I think it's helpful to always frame our practice the way the Buddha did, that he taught one thing and one thing only. And that is how dukkha arises and how it ceases, what causes our suffering and what is the release of that suffering. And this simple way of understanding can be really helpful to always come back to realize, okay, how am I holding these two? This is reflected in the Four Noble Truths, is reflected in dependent origination, understanding this very origination of dukkha, but also, as importantly, understanding the cessation of that dukkha. Of course, there's other aspects that are needed to support our practice, to create the conditions for us to develop and deepen. But our maturity and our depth of our practice really does depend on both these being in place. Now, sometimes we stay focused on the suffering to understand, okay, why is my mind so painful? Why is my heart so contracted? You know, if I just focus on my pain and my suffering, and yet we never take our heads out of the water to actually see the release that's available, the sense of freedom that's available moment by moment. And by doing this, we have this risk of making our spiritual growth a never-ending project. We're trying to always overcome ourselves, to fix ourselves, to better ourselves, to get through our pain in some way. And this is actually a fairly easy delusion to keep in place, that I'm working on myself, even the sense of myself, never challenging that essential assumption that I am doing this. Like the basic assumption of turning toward my pain, turning toward my discomfort, and keeps this essentialness of me, essential ground under my feet is intact. It creates a sense of certainty, even as we touch very tender places. So this is exploring the side of dukkha, understanding the origination of dukkha. Of course, it's very essential. On the other hand, if we just focus on the liberation side of it, the cessation of dukkha, the aspect of awakening, of enlightenment, we risk what's been coined spiritual bypassing. That if we go into this, avoiding the messiness of our lives, the messiness of our relationships and our conflicts, retreating instead to the bliss of the meditative state. You know, and so certainly the problems of our lives, if we're not thinking about them, there's a way in which they disappear. But when we come back into the reality of our life, we're often met or confronted with that, the mess that's there. One teacher described this or had a reflection that we can take someone who's a sage from the Far East or the Near East and, you know, in the cave and in their monastery, their temple or everything, they have a deep sense of peace and a deep sense of ease, of attainment, of awakening. And then you take them here to the West and give them family and kids, a wife, a spouse, a husband, a lover, give them a job and see how well their awakening holds up. And so often that keeping that sense of aloofness, of distance from life, doesn't allow us to really integrate our practice. So this past few weeks with contact, we've been exploring this sense of how dukkha arises, how our sense of story shapes this moment of contact, which on first glance may seem like it should just be a neutral thing. We hear the bell and we all have the same sound that reaches our ears. Yet if we were falling asleep, the bell has a certain resonance in us. If we're very deep in meditation, it has a different resonance. If we're fighting and struggling in our bodies and our minds, the bell has a different thing that it elicits. So it's interesting how this quality of kind of predisposition to this moment is always there. And tonight, though, I'd like to focus more on the cessation of dukkha side of things and what happens when there is not this momentum into suffering, into dukkha. movement along this cycle of dependent origination. So most of this month, I've been focusing on this moment of contact and how it's not neutral. How when we hear something, sense something, taste something, see something, think something, our story arises with that. And so often we're actually viewing not the reality of this moment experience, but actually our story of it, our idea of it. That's based on our conditioning. It's based on what we've added to this moment, our history around it, our momentum of it. This is working from the dukkha side of this experience. In some ways, we've been backtracking with dependent origination, noticing this moment and how this whole sense of story arises with that. Now, what if we worked with this idea of contact, this reality of contact, from the cessation side, from the awakened side of it, the end of suffering? What does that look like? What is this liberation in itself? In a sutta from the Udana, the Buddha said, "There is, monks, an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned." There is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned. If, monks, there was no unborn, no unbecome, no unmade, unconditioned, no escape would be discerned from what is born, what is become, what is made, what is conditioned. This phrase of being born is this phrase of dependent origination. We're really going into the nitty-gritty of that. This condition is our past history shaping this moment. And the Buddha goes on to say, but because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, therefore an escape is discerned. It is possible. Right? So this is a little obtuse, perhaps. But is it, maybe to make it more concrete, is it possible to meet this moment free of our past conditioning, free of the momentum of our history, our memories, our past actions? So we're meeting it with a sense of deep innocence, a deep sense of intimacy. You know, can this moment of contact be completely and totally freed from our story, totally freed from our conditioning, so it truly is neutral? To help explain this, I came across an article that Joseph Goldstein wrote in the Tricycle magazine, the Buddhist magazine, called The End of Suffering. And in the teachings of some of the Thai masters, there's a distinction made between the consciousness that's included in the five aggregates and that arises dependent on one of the six sense objects. Another kind of consciousness called citta, or heart-mind. This consciousness, in its pure and unmodified state, is beyond the aggregates. It is called the signless, because it has no sign of impermanence or other signs by which it can be known. This is the mind free of any defilement. Okay, so what Joseph is pointing toward is our normal sense of consciousness, and the consciousness that we explored in dependent origination has this quality of being kind of preloaded, preset to receive sensory data in a certain way. I hear a bell and I'm react to it. I like it, I don't like it. Right? That's based on your conditioning as a meditator. But there's this other quality of consciousness that's not dependent upon, that's not inherently tied into this selfing, that's not inherently tied into this sense of me, of I, me, and mine. This is this citta, this heart mind. So I want to give an example, analogy really, to kind of help this hopefully land a little more for you. So imagine we went out into the woods and found a still pool of water. You know, there's no wind, so it has a mirror finish on it. Now, if we take a stone and throw it into that stone, of course, splashes, and there's ripples that we can see obviously echo out throughout that pond. Right, so using this simple analogy, let's say that the pond itself is our consciousness, is our sense of knowing. that also has certain qualities. It has qualities of viscosity, of momentum, that's based on our past history. So how, in the moment of the stone hitting it, is a moment of contact, hearing a bell, tasting something, seeing something, feeling something, thinking something. This is the stone launching through the air and making that contact with that pool. And from that moment of contact, then all these ripples come forth. These ripples are this, the rest of this year of dependent origination, of looking at the quality of Vedana, of pleasant or unpleasant, or neutral, the sense of craving, of clinging, of becoming. All these are echoes of the ripples in this analogy. And how big the ripples are, how fast they move, this is all based on our conditioning and how we've kind of predisposed it. And this ripples are this movement along the cycle of dependent origination, spreading into wanting, of not wanting, into birthing. It's like the echoes going out. And this is the result of the water and the stone striking the water and the characteristics of the water. Now, often in our lives, there's many stones falling all at once. So we have one stone and there's ripples coming out, and another stone and other ripples. And we never quite perceive the end of those ripples because another one's hitting before. Some of them make a big splash and have a lot of reaction, and we kind of track that for a while. And we're relieved when it ends. Other ones have a big splash and we're just delighted that it's here until it passes. And then we're like, oh, I wish that would come back. Now here's with this analogy, if this quality of the lake or the pond changes, let's say it's more muddy. It's quite muddy. And so when the stone hits, it has more viscosity. It's more sticky. It goes slow and sluggish. Or if it's starting to freeze and how the water becomes slushy. Also, the impact is going to be very different. So the stone is the same. The moment of contact is the same. But the water that's receiving it is different. Same, too, as our sense of consciousness can be different receiving the various moments of contact. Some contacts are very easy and just ignored. Others have a deep sense of impact on us. Okay, so this is stating it from the dukkha side of things. You know, what is the origin of dukkha? What's the cause of dukkha? What is dukkha? The sense of contact and our reaction coming from it, the ripples coming out from that moment of contact. Okay, so now imagine that stone is thrown through the air, and when it meets the water, it just passes through without any ripple, without any splash. Like it's passing through something unsubstantial, like passing through a vapor, that there's nothing solid or liquid in this case to meet it, to react to it, to have its past triggered. Okay, so this is going into the nibbana side, the liberation side of meeting this moment, that when a sense comes to us, if it simply passes through us without triggering a reaction, without creating this sense of self, if it's not met by our history, by our story, it passes through. And we're completely intimate to it, we completely know it, and we completely release it all in one. This is what the Buddha said around this. Just as if there were a roofed house, or a roofed hall having windows on the north, the south, or the east. When the sun rises and a ray has entered by way of the window, where does it land? Right? So the Buddha loved to teach in metaphor, an analogy. So you see this house sitting here with these windows, sunlight's coming through. And he's asking the monk, where does it land? Where does that light land? Where does the sunlight land? And the monk says, on the western wall, Lord. And if there is no western wall, where does it land? On the ground, Lord. And if there is no ground, where does it land? On the water, Lord. And if there is no water, where does it land? It does not land, Lord. And the Buddhist goes on to say, in the same way, when there's no passion for nutriment or physical food, of contact, of intellectual intention, of consciousness, when there's no craving, no clinging, no aversion, then consciousness does not land there or increase. That, I tell you, has no sorrow, affliction, or despair. So when the light lands on something, that's our normal way of being in the world. As meditators, the light lands into forms of a ripple of, you know, reactivity. Like, oh, my spouse said this to me, or my dog did this. And that reaction has its own ripples. It lands, it makes contact. Now, if it doesn't land, if it has no place to land, that's the release of this clinging, this craving, this selfing. It has no place or ground. So this is the present moment, experienced completely free of our past, free of our conditioning. This moment of contact, of a sensation, of a thought, of a sound, completely received in this field of emptiness, of awareness. So as a result, there's no reactivity arises. There's no impulse to do something with this. This is often a hallmark, is when we're in this deep place of receptivity, when our story has quieted enough to really truly see, there's not this impulse that comes into action. Action could be as simple as thinking, as leaning toward, leaning away from some experience. So often it's not the case. And that's what we've been working on now, is the moment, until now, this moment of contact comes. And how can I release the story? How can I release my preconceptions, my pre-ideas of this moment, and simply meet it how it is? But there's the cessation side of practice, is to see the emptiness itself. We can release the deep story in itself, so we're meeting the moment fully, without our ideas, without our, even the label of that, without the sense of me having to meet that. And then the reaction just does not arise. It's like that water suddenly receives the stone without any resistance. The stone passes through a field of consciousness without disturbing, without creating a ripple, without moving along this cycle of a dependent origination. There's a famous sutta with the Buddha. He gives very clear instructions around this, very direct instructions, called the Bahiya Sutta, that many of you are familiar with. And the Bahiya Sutta is a very beautiful sutta, and it shows this urgency of this spiritual seeker, this spiritual student who had been going the wrong direction and realizing that he had such a urgency and such a ripeness to hear the direct teachings. And so the Buddha gave it to him. And he said this. The Buddha said, "Then, Bahiya, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will only be the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. In reference to the seen, only the seen." So he's instructing him to somehow figure out how not to bring his story to bear and what he sees. To even deeper than that, not to have that story even arise. So again, in practice, we often have to work with that story arises and learning how to release it. But eventually, that story starts to not arise in of its own. And in the scene, there's only the scene. The Buddha goes on to say, "When for you there will only be the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then Bahiya." Okay, this is a very beautiful part. "Then Bahiya, there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When there's no you there, you're neither here nor yonder nor between the two. Just this is the end of suffering." is the end of dukkha. So it's such direct, clear teaching that when there's not the sense of me who's experiencing what's the contact point, when the seeing, the hearing, the taste, the thought, there's simply something else that's knowing that doesn't have to go through this kind of step of claiming I, claiming me, claiming mine. And upon hearing this, Bahia became awakened. So this sutta, you know, may not make sense. It may be obtuse. It may not connect with you because it asks us to see life in a very different way. I mean, this whole talk may be like that, perhaps. You know, may, our practice may not be in that place right now. And, you know, and I do see this as a process that there, we go through times and we're really focused on the liberative qualities, the releasing qualities. Other times we're really focused on the contraction of the mind and the heart. And ideally, we have this reference, this North Pole, toward the end of suffering, the end of dukkha, which is the one and the same in the end of this illusion of self. Of course, this sutta may resonate with you, may touch aspects of yourself, aspects of your what you've seen and your understanding, perhaps touches of it, tastes of it, sometimes very deep understanding. And also this sutta and this kind of exploration may have a quality of being a little unsettling, a little bit disconcerting. I want to speak to that for a moment. Because there's this sense of ground that we have, this sense of orientation that we have, that we really base our whole lives on. We basically, I'm going through my life, I'm having my successes, my failures, my losses, my gains, my fames, my disreputes, my pleasures, my pains. This is all in reference to me experiencing this. And as meditators, we bring that basic perspective into our practice that, okay, I'm learning how to marshal my distracted mind and connect with this breath, connect with this sensation. And as that deepens and matures, there's a quality of more abiding stillness, abiding peace that arises. Yet all along, we can have this sense of me being in the middle of it, me experiencing this breath, this sensation, me having to work with those problems with this mind that's so depressed, that's so anxious, that's so distracted. The problem, and actually the problem, that the thing that created it, are struggling with each other. And we start to follow the Buddha's instructions. When we start to see in the seeing only the seeing, we start to allow that sense of allowing the stone to cross right through that pond. There's this release of the ground. There's a release of this fundamental orientation that we have held as being true throughout our whole lives. We've lived our whole lives based upon that. And sometimes in that moment of stillness, we think, oh, well, you know, this meditation is feeling really deep and still. And suddenly we find that suddenly the meditation is meditating itself. That we're not in the middle of it. It feels like the sense of ground falls away. This frame of reference can fall away. We know that stones are supposed to make a splash and cause ripples when we throw them. I'm supposed to have an opinion about the moment, a thought about the moment, a reaction. I'm supposed to have something to struggle with, to do with this moment. And when that falls away, whether it's just for a moment of seeing or for a longer abiding, it sometimes can feel like a free fall. Like if you were on those roller coasters that suddenly drop you unexpectedly and your belly has that sensation, the very ground falls away. So this is something that can be, again, a little disconcerting, a little bit unsettling when it arises, sometimes quite profoundly unsettling. And yet this is the deepest intention of the practice. The Buddha said it this way, that consciousness without feature, without end, luminous all around, here water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing. Here long and short, coarse and fine, fair and foul, name and form, are all brought to an end. With the sensation of the activity of consciousness, each is here brought to an end. Here, water, earth, fire, and wind, all the aspects of our physical reality have no footing. Here, long and short, coarse and fine, fair and foul, name and form, are all brought to an end. This is this falling away of the ground. And yes, it can be scary, disconcerting, disorienting, because we've based our life upon this. And yet, it's an important signpost. It's such an important signpost that we're moving beyond long-held assumptions, long-held premises that we've based everything on. It's like a whole field of science. It's built upon these underlying laws. And we suddenly see those laws are actually just ideas, actually just premises, which are actually relatively true, not absolutely true. And we see that they're not absolutely true. There's that shifting of our foundation. And by doing this, by really looking at these fundamental assumptions, they're also looking at the fundamental assumptions that hold us in suffering. The sensation of dukkha, the sensation of suffering. Now this is kind of this talk is kind of bringing out a direct pointing, hopefully. But I want to just pause for a moment and just also contrast this approach, because it is in some ways really going, dissolving the very foundations of our assumptions of the world and ourselves in that world. That needs to be balanced and contrasted with the need for stability, with the need for safety, for the need for ground. Remember, I was teaching with a co-teacher, and we're giving out the instructions, and I would often talk about the need for feeling that sense of safety, that sense of ground. And she was saying, well, how there really is no safety. You know, and she was talking from this absolute standpoint. And I was talking more from the relativeness of safety. Because each one of us, we have to have that sense of security, that often we come to practice with ourselves very, very much wounded, with a sense of deficiency, of self-hatred, of trauma, perhaps, that we need to learn to befriend ourselves, to have enough care and love, really, for ourselves to be able to release. That trying to get over our dysfunction, to get over our pain by the allure of this stillness and the peace that it promises, it doesn't work. It comes back and bites us. To learn how to find that sense of meaning, what's here, that when my heart is contracted, when I'm feeling reactive, I meet that with the sense of what's the relative stillness, a relative safety in this moment. Looking, a simple way we've often explored is looking around your environment, seeing what is safe in the moment, what is neutral in the moment, to reassure the mind that's worried, the mind that's panicked, that's anxious, that there is this quality of stability. So we balance that. We balance that with also going against, right up against the edge of our world and stepping off. And we should never force that stepping off. It should really be drawn by our hearts, drawn by a sense of curiosity, of the heart's yearning, not by a sense of to-do or forcing. We need to ultimately meet ourselves where we are. It's such an essence of the meditative journey is, where am I right now? Not where I think I should be, or where I was last week or last sit, but where am I right here, right now? Perhaps the mind is fatigued, contracted. It's much more helpful to learn to meet that than to try to force yourselves to be something other than you are. And it changes our practice as we go through life, and as our practice changes. We may go through periods of a deep connection to this stillness, and then we go through a period of really needing to find our ground under our feet. Other times that ground, we think, since I've been hanging on to this ground too long, this underlying assumption, I need to start to question that, to start to release into what's beyond that ground, to surrender into the formless. Now, the guided meditation and the homework for this week hopefully starts to speak to this. You know, we started this whole month working with contact and how the moment of contact, any of the sense gates, often has this inherent something else that comes with it. We see our movement to engage with it. And really what we're seeing is this momentum of our past history, our what we've added to the moment, learning to our story, our conditioning, our sankharas, the shaping of our consciousness, our expression of name and form. Right? So these are all the technical terms that we've worked with this year, but it's really noticing what we've added to this moment and learning to subtract that, to come back again and again to this, the basic essence of what is being felt, sensed, known. Okay, we can take that a step further, not, you know, through relaxation, through a sense of ease. We can't do this through tension. We can't do this through will or force. We're bringing a quality of receptivity, a sense of allowing. To start to notice the sense of me who's experiencing it. And doing this in a almost playful way, an almost curious way. Like, what if I didn't have to be here to experience this? What if something else that's I don't have to be responsible for is already knowing this experience, is already sensing this? And letting this sense of me-ness, of I-ness, soften, kind of go into the backdrop and see if there isn't something that's already knowing, that's already receiving this moment, completely outside of our influence. And that feels a little sense of, oh, I don't quite know where I am with that. You know, you're on the right track. As we start to see something we thought was solid really isn't. Again, we have to do this with, there's a sense of receptivity, a sense of ease of mind, a sense of stillness that is very helpful to open to this perspective, because it really is a readjustment of our perspective. And if it really opens up in a way that we see that clearly, we often feel like, okay, the ground has, I used to be able to kind of choose to go on the ground and off the ground, and suddenly the ground is not there. And I feel like I'm in a free fall. There's like this sense of having nothing to land on. One teacher described that as that matures, you know, you're falling through the air like without a parachute and screaming. And then you see someone else who just kind of laid back and just relaxing with it and saying, yeah, it just keeps going like this. It's no big deal. You can just relax and enjoy that. This is when we stop believing the fear and actually open to the experience of wonder, of intimacy that's present. Now, Zen has this way of pointing toward this truth, this understanding in a very vivid, very direct way toward this release of ground. So this phrase, it's kind of an intense phrase, but I forget whose sage said this, that basically when you see your parents, when you meet your parents on the road, you kill your parents. When you see the Buddha, kill the Buddha. So this is not a statement of violence, of that's so much that's where the word kill comes up. It's much more of a sense of, if you see where you've been born from, if you see what something that you hold so dear as being separate from yourself, even the stuff you hold so dear is what drives you forward, you know, is holding that sense of aspiration toward your parents. That's always coming from that's coming from a sense of duality, a sense of distinction. So when you see that sense of separation, to allow that too, to let that go also. It's pointing toward, this simple phrase is pointing toward kind of some of the deepest ways we tend to hold our ground, a sense of reference point, to even let that go, to even let that release. Now, if you start to get a taste of this, or if just hearing about it, it's like you kind of get a sense of it. Often a question that comes up is that, how do I live from this place? How do I live from this perspective? Like, if the past isn't arising, if my story isn't arising, there's not me present to meet this moment's contact, then what's driving the bus? What's running the show here? You know, the sense of me is not present to meet this moment. Even the impulse to move, to become, even the sense of Vedana becomes less and less clear. Because there's not this impulse to move, to act from, to think around something, is based on the sense of Vedana, which we'll go into next month in July in a lot of detail. This is Vedana as being pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And how that simple flavoring of the moment sets us up into wanting or not wanting, or doing something with. If it's pleasant, I get rid of it. If it's unpleasant, I get rid of it. If it's pleasant, I get more of it. Now, if the sense of who gets rid of it doesn't make sense anymore, say the whole motivation of our whole life doesn't make sense. Another way to say it is, we're not ego-driven. We're not in relationship to the ego. You know, so often we try to be like this, and it just doesn't make sense to try to be anything other than what's really right here, right now. And so then it takes a while for something else to start to move us. It's not driven by the selfing, not driven by our story, not driven by our reactivity. I mean, this is really the suffering that we deal with, that we perhaps came to the practice in the first place. When the practice actually bears fruit, then how do we move in life? How do we have relationships? How do we have jobs? And after a while, something else starts to move us, that we start to move from stillness. We start to move from love, from connection. And always knowing that even while we engage in the forms of life and the details of life, we in the essence know that we are formless, that we are empty. All right, if we could just sit quietly for a few moments. All right, thank you for your kind attention. I'm going to send a chat out with the homework for this week. It kind of gets all smushed together, so hopefully you can copy and paste it and then make it look pretty. And so you can take a look at that and think of any questions that might come up. I'm just going to go over that first, so we can kind of be on the same page for this next week's of practice around this topic. So we can almost frame this whole talk, this whole exploration, as releasing into stillness, releasing into a sense of ease. So trying this exercise when the mind is at ease, when it's receptive and still. So it might be while you're meditating, it might be while you're just sitting, you know, out in nature, or sitting in your home with nothing to do. And if that the conditions are like that, there's a receptivity, there's an ease, and there's a stillness, try releasing deeply into each moment of sense contact. Releasing the stories, the impulses, the labels that arise with that contact. Simply rest in the knowing of each moment. So practice with that. Get a sense of that. What is it like to meet the moment kind of free of my conditioning? Now, invite a deeper sense of a deeper release of the idea of you experiencing this contact. inviting a deeper release of the idea of you experiencing this contact. Get a sense that maybe the sense of me that seems so predominant, so all-pervasive, is maybe just an idea, just a thought. Now, what if the idea of me didn't need to be present to be aware? What if the idea of me didn't need to be present to be aware? With curiosity, with innocence, allow the essence of awareness to simply directly know. You know, play with this in a sense of, again, with ease, with relaxation, with stillness. Can I allow the essence of awareness itself to simply know? Let the sense of me rest. This is a tremendous rest to start to set this aside. Allow it to soften. Allow it to start to dissolve. So try this a few times this week and see what arises, what your experience is. All right, so now we have some time for any comments or questions or sharing, and I'll give you the ability to unmute yourself. So you can just unmute yourself and ask a question, or if you want to send chat or raise your hand. May not see you immediately, but Khaled is helping with the co-host may find you. Everybody's speechless. I never know if that's a good thing or not.
Tim, is it okay if I say something?
Yes.
This is Iris.
Hi, Iris.
Thank you for that talk. I've heard those ideas before from you and many other teachers, and tonight they feel very kind of difficult for me to sort of feel into them, and you know, and I'm sort of amused at that as I say it, because it's sort of what you're talking about, the paradox of me, a self, trying to understand, you know, which is sort of not the way to understand. So it's just kind of amusing to me. And so just that's where I'm at right now, and that's okay.
Yes. Yes, yeah, absolutely. That sense of, you know, kind of that sense of not quite resonating, or that sense of kind of struggle with this exploration, you know, it's, and the amusement, I think that's a really good sign, right? Because, you know, perhaps a few years earlier, you would have been like frustrated, you know, like, okay, why aren't I getting this? So that sense of amusement, okay, the mind doesn't understand right now. And I think that's, it's really helpful to just acknowledge that deeply as you are. Okay, there's the mind is confused, or is not understanding, or is struggling with this. This seems like very conceptual, so far beyond, you know, that. And that's actually the most kind of honest response to the mind to this topic. It's like, what are you talking about? This is, because it's like the whole reality is completely different from what the mind's reality is, or the sense of self's reality. It's like talking to a fish and saying, you know, there's a world that's not based in water. It's like everything the fish sees is permeated with water. It's just like even the idea of water is hard to understand. And that's really the part of practice which has that mystery to it, that sense of, okay, what is that? So if it has a, if it has a, some sense of interest, if it's like, well, you know, it seems like they talk about it for some reason, it must be something worth going into. So, okay, hold, you know, notice that and let that lead you through. So the other hand of it is if there has been more receptivity at other times, to realize that sometimes the mind just gets reactive and resistant, and not to try to force to the resistance with a battering ram, but much more of a sense of meeting that resistance very kindly, very sweetly. It's like noticing, oh, the confusion, the resistance. This is, I mean, this is one of the inner teachings of the hindrances, if I can use that inner teaching sense, is that hindrances are often these kind of barriers, these things that come up in the midst of practice. If you look at how the hindrances are often, what do you call it, described or represented in the suttas, it's in the god of Mara, of god of delusion. And he would come and try to trick the Buddha and try to get the Buddha to get off his seat. His Night of Enlightenment was the most, you know, the most famous of that, when he would, the Buddha resolved not to move until he achieved awakening. And Mara would, you know, test him and challenge him and throw all these armies of greed and hatred, of fear against him, of lust, of desire, of doubt. And the Buddha kept coming back again and again. And so and this happened even after he was awakened. The Buddha would come, Mara would come and try to trick the Buddha, and the Buddha would eventually say, okay, I see you, Mara. And then Mara would get disgruntled and slunk away. So yeah, it's the, you know, this is just trying to include this element of the Dharma. It's such an essential element. And sometimes our minds are not receptive to it. And that's perfectly fine. Thank you, Iris.
Sam? I have something to share if nobody else wants to speak right now. This your talk is exactly where I've been for the past 3 weeks. It was like, wow, you know. I've noticed a strong sense of separation. I've had ancestral stories to back it up. I've had current stories to back it up. And it's been really, really painful. And I weave in and out of separation and unity kind of a thing. Like, and I think today, actually, I've finally gotten to a place where weaving in and out, but I finally got into a place where the separation felt so painful that I felt like there was only self-hate. It was only comparison. I could only compare myself with other people or judge or, you know, whatever. And so I started asking the question, may I know love? Because I felt like I couldn't find it. I felt like it wasn't there. And then today it's sort of like the stories have fallen away. And, you know, I know this is temporary and that was temporary. But it feels like I really understand what you're saying. I totally get it. And it's just, it's like, actually last night I listened to a Dharma talk by Sally Armstrong on comparing mind, because I was just so lost in it.
Yes.
I think that helped me to push me over the edge a little bit. It was just like right there. I just needed to hear it. Yeah. So anyway, thank you for your talk.
You're welcome, Mia. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, you know, the sense of struggle in our practice, I mean, we're so conditioned in our culture to think struggle is bad. You know, struggle is something that shouldn't be happening. I shouldn't be caught in my self-judgment. And it can be so painful when we have this, especially have that, as you said, weaving back and forth, and we realize, oh, there's this potential of not being caught in comparing mind or struggle mind. And yet I go back into it. I'm helpless to it. I think this is why so many mythology stories, so many spiritual stories have this component of struggle. You know, think of Jesus in 40 days in the desert. Think of the 6 years of Buddha's quest for awakening and how much he punished his body and pushed the limits to, you know, that sense of struggle, that sense of working with that. And as the Buddha found is that, you know, maybe it's not, it doesn't have to be so hard, that famous apple tree sutta, where you just sat under the apple tree with a relaxed, receptive mind. And we learn that each time we see that, we see the falling away, as you've done, as you did today, that falling away, that asking, you know, let me know love, that sense of aspiration, that sense of intention, that sense of prayer, that sense of let me know love. Because that's the humorous thing, is that we seek and seek and seek, and yet it's right here. It's literally right here. We just become blind to it. And it's, students, it can be so discouraging when we're in the midst of that blindness, in the midst of that struggle, in the midst of the hindrance attack, of the doubt. But yet, often when it's the deepest, the strongest, you know, that's right before it starts to, it's about to let go. And that's the perspective that, you know, as the privilege of being a teacher, is I get to see people go through that. And I see that, oh, the struggle that you're having now, it's not going to be there forever. It may actually be the beginning of something very deeply releasing. And so thank you for sharing that, Cheryl.
Thank you, Tim.
Tim?
Yes.
Tim?
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah. I found very helpful a thing you said earlier about rejecting the endless project of working on myself or fixing myself. Did I restate that correctly?
Yes.
That's a tremendous propensity of mine, and it really does feel endless. I'm intrigued by this prospect of just kind of facing a different direction, or maybe you could talk a little more about what the first step would be in a different approach, just in that moment of being weary of fix-up projects.
Yeah, so that's, I think, a very common, you know, experience that we have, is we have these constant projects, this constant busyness, and that you're referring to that Rinpoche's quote about that, telling his mind to relax, to just sit still in the midst of the endless projects. Can you actually use the template from the Four Noble Truths to start with? It's just to notice, okay, there is dukkha here. There is suffering in that. That sense of always not being quite enough, always having to do something more to attain something, to overcome something. And so you have to let go for a second of the things you're trying to obtain and the story that you know, tells you that, okay, if I finally get this, then I will be this. To actually notice that sense of restlessness, that sense of never being enough, and how it just drives us again and again. This is opening to the first noble truth of dukkha, and noticing how that originates, how that deep hunger to do, to be, is really showing a deeper hunger than that of forming the sense of me, the sense of self. And, you know, be forewarned that if you start to see that, you should say, okay, if I don't pursue what I've been pursuing my whole life, the constant to-doing, the constant projects, if I make myself unemployed, you can feel that sense of, well, what is life going to be about? What am I going to do? So you see both in those moments, you see both the pain and the suffering of always doing, of always wanting, but also see the unseen payoff. That really having endless projects is a great way to keep yourself intact, right? Because you're okay, I keep reaffirming myself. Because we start to, you know, as our practice, you know, as it starts to see more clearly and more deeply, we see that the sense of me is actually inherently pretty unstable. I don't mean that in terms of a mental health standpoint, but much more of, we have to constantly add energy to the system to make the sense of me. Like I have to keep reaffirming myself. I have to keep reaffirming my opinions. sometimes you feel this, you know, with your friends or with the workplace, that I have to assert myself to say, okay, this is what I think, and you have to have your voice heard. And of course, I'm not trying to discount all that, the need of that. But at a certain stage, we kind of get tired of the need to do that. And so then we say, okay, there's that constant energy that comes up. So I start to let go of that need, then that energy gets freed up. But more fundamentally, there's that sense of, okay, what's running this show here if I'm not involved so much? So I guess a simple way to sum it up is notice that, you know, the detriment of that constant pattern. Just start to see through the illusion that it gives you. Okay, start to also see what the kind of the payoff it has. And then start to be sensitive to noticing times when I'm not engaging in that, what arises. And if there's a sense of a little unease, a little sense of fear or disorientation, really pay attention to that. Not as something to get over, but actually go more into. It's like you're, you know, walking around on the ground and suddenly there's this big gap here where your ground no longer is there. Instead of running away from that, which is what the pattern tells you to do, see if you can kind of get to know that. See if yourself kind of putting one foot into that sense of not projecting yourself. All right, thank you, Kathy. All right, we have time, I think, for maybe one more before we go into announcements.
I can go, Tim.
Hello.
Every single person, every word that came out of their mouths, it's like it was me. Like, so Sangha has me see that there is no me. Like, it's all like, oh, I could have said what Ira said. I could have said what I was suffering over, what Cheryl was suffering. I had my version, you know. Kathy, I have my list that, like, doesn't go away, and I want the magic bullet to make it go away. So it's like there. It's like my access to that place of calm was just hearing everyone being like my head right out here from everyone else. It's like evidence to me that the thing you spoke to around, we have to work to keep self going. We actually have to work. We have to remind ourselves of the list. We have to remind ourselves of the suffering. We have to keep all those things in place, the stories we tell to everyone around us, to keep the self in place. Because without those, really, that rock does just go down. Yes. And the humanity of it and the globalness of it, like, it's not personal to me, my list. Is not personal. It's like, I'm human being, I'm ego, I have a list. Yep. So the Iris is the, like, the humor to it, and like I just laugh all through Sangha. I'm always smiling just because it's like, yep, that's me, yep. That's, oh yeah, Tim, that was for me, yep. That, And it's just so evident in everyone sharing. I had to say it because it was like personal. When you started to ask for sharing occurred, and it was no longer personal. It was like, oh, these mouths are saying what's in my head. So it's like the self slow, all the structures for Suzanne's identity were slowly like, wait, you're suffering too. You have a to-do list. You have confusion. You have concern. You have then. Then there's nothing. Then I'm like, oh, There's nothing. Uh-oh. Better find that self. That ground. So the ground was dropping. As each person said something, the ground was slowly dropping. So, and I didn't even know what you were saying about that at the beginning. It didn't make sense. Like, I made sense, but I couldn't access it until other people spoke. And then I accessed it. So just thank you all for speaking.
Very well said, Suzanne. You know, that's that sense of, you know, the power of the Sangha, that we we do take it very personally. This is my, I'm the only one who's ever had this in the history of humankind. And there's this sense of personalization of that, which is really a hardened sense of self. And you said that really nicely, how the sense of hearing other people voice the very same experience you're having, you realize, oh, there's just this human mind. There's this human mind of suffering, of dukkha that happens, and there's also the release of that. And seeing that because it's shared by everyone, it's not yours. And noticing how there's that impulse to contract back around that. Well, I want to be special. I want to be the only one who's as miserable. and we realize, oh, wow, we're not. Then suddenly, it's a much different way of being compassionate. It's a much different way of being empathetic. And this is why it's said that the natural expression of the awakened mind is of compassion, is of sympathetic joy. Because we do see that there is no difference between my mind and your mind. You know, it may have different shapes, perhaps, different flavorings, but the essence of the struggle is shared. And if we're really able to hear that and sense that, it can have, you know, have an insightful experience, and that can happen any moment. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. All right, so we have some announcements. And before Iris goes into those, I just want to say a few words about Donna. And I'll send a link again for Donna. So Donna, as you probably know, is a Pali word for generosity, the act of giving. And the way that this tradition was really landed in the West, it was based on trying to honor the sense of Donna, of generosity. And it was a very conscious choice by the founders, the Western people who went to Asia and brought it back, to not engage in the normal economy, the normal way that we function in this society of this is how much something costs and this is how much it's worth. And they decided to take really a risk to say, okay, we will not charge a fee for our teachings, but to trust that people will support us. It's quite courageous because this is not a supportive idea in our culture. You go to Asia, or like near my house, there's a Thai monastery, and the Thai people, locals who live here and in the area, they come and they support the monastics. I mean, that's just part of what you do in your society. But we don't have that same resonance or that same equivalent in our society. But as a teacher, it's a wonderful teaching because it comes to that edge. Instead of coming to teach from a place of, okay, this is how much I'll get for this night or this event, it's open-ended. It's a place of vulnerability, of trust, of really letting go of the agenda of self, of even those basic needs of meeting my expenses. And so in return, it seems to have been working for 2,600 years that the teachings are offered freely, and people freely then offer support to the organizations like SIMS and to the teachers to help this teaching continue, this the ability to hear the Dharma, the liberating teachings of the Dharma. It's such a precious gift. So please consider supporting SIMS, and there's a link there for Seattle Insight, and it's under the Donate tab. And then there's information to donate to Twary or myself there also. And then there's also some stuff for me directly through PayPal, Venmo, or Zelle, through Guile at timguile@seattleinsight.org, or PayPal me at timguile. So thank you again for your support and your engagement. And this is, I think, the best thing we can spend our time with.